Welcome to Come Inside.
This week's guest is Jeff Scoop. And Jeff was a really interesting interview to have because it actually ties in with the last episode that you listened to, which was with the current commander of the National Socialist Movement. And Jeff Scoop was the previous commander of that group. In fact, he led that group for 25 years until he decided to retire in early 2019. And instead of sitting back and remaining silent, he decided to speak out and help others. At the start of this year, he founded a non-profit organization called Beyond Barriers, which is dedicated to helping people leave extremist organizations, as well as providing support to individuals and communities affected by extremism. This was an interesting chat because it's someone who was in that group who is now out of it. And Jeff now works also as an international extremist consultant, human rights activist, and a public speaker. And he works towards promoting peace, and he wants to educate communities and policy makers on the threat of extremism. This is a really important topic, especially when you look at all the stuff that's going on in the world right now. And there have been a lot of questions asked of this guy. Is he for real? Do you believe him? And people have really different views about this. I put these questions to him. Some of the things he didn't answer, some of the things he did answer. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you to everyone who has contacted me about the last episode, and even had a few people asking me if it was a hoax and a joke and how could someone think that way. And I'm telling you, it wasn't. That is legitimately what that guy thinks and feels and all the rest of it. But yeah, this is a different angle of a similar type of conversation. So take a listen. And if you want to know more about Jeff, you can go to jeffscoop.com. So here's the episode. Thanks for listening. Enjoy.
How'd your interview go with the NSM?
Yeah, interesting. Your name actually got brought up, which was kind of random. I didn't tell him I was going to be interviewing you. I just let him kind of go off. They stand for everything that I'm against. So it was kind of hard to sit there and listen. He didn't really answer the questions I found. Like I'd ask him the question and then he'd kind of skirt around it. And so I'd reword it and I'd keep doing that until he'd answer the question, which I was kind of expecting. So I was kind of prepared for that. Besides that, like he was kind of a nice guy, but I just, some of the things he said, I was like, come on, like you can't be serious. Yes, it's interesting. Do you know that Bert Colucci guy?
He was my chief of staff when I was running the NSM. So yeah, when I left the group, he was the one that was appointed to run it.
Okay, I see. Okay, yeah, he didn't mention that. He did mention you. He called you a traitor and an enemy, and you know what? I would expect him to say that, as I'm sure you would as well.
Yep. Yeah, that's the way they view it. Once you start speaking out against hate and things like that, they just see it as like the worst, the absolute worst.
Yeah. Of course. I wanted to understand how you got involved with the National Socialist Movement.
Whoa, that's a long story. Let's see. So I got involved at a very young age, when I was a teenager. I guess the way that I was originally interested in it was my grandfather fought, my grandparents came over from Germany to the United States, and my grandfather fought in the Hitler's army in the Third Reich. So, and so did my great uncles, my grandmother's brothers. So I had this fascination with history, with the historical, you know, the German side of things. You know, it was always, it was something that was interest to me from a very young age. And from that historical curiosity, you know, a lot of young boys have this curiosity about war and the military and things like that. Unfortunately, my curiosity sent me sort of to the German side of that. And going forward, as I became a teenager, my goal was to join, you know, that movement in the United States or the closest thing to it. So by the time I was, when I was 15, I went over and stayed with family in Germany for a summer. And then by the time I was 18, you know, I found the movement here in the United States and got involved in it.
Okay. What was it about the Germany side of it that appealed to you?
Probably the structure, the interest in their military and things like that. And, you know, as a boy, you know, I really looked up to my grandfather. You know, I found him to be a really interesting person, a strong person, you know. So I think that was that's where the fascination started. And then, you know, just wanted to hear about the war and learn about it and things like that. And I think for a lot of young boys, I think, you know, finding that military, that fascination in the military and all that is normal. But, you know, finding that fascination in the Third Reich side, maybe not so normal, you know, unfortunately.
Yeah. Okay. So you were involved in the group for 27 years. And of that, you spent 25 years as the commander. What kind of things did you do as a member of this group?
Well, so I joined back in the 1990s, and you're right, you know, I spent 27 years there, 25 in the leadership position. So early on, it was a lot of, you know, demonstrations, leafleting, you know, passing out flyers, leaflets, recruiting face-to-face in some cases. Basically, the group is organized in a structure. It was like a social structure in some ways back then, you know. So you would meet people, you'd get together, and you would, you know, spread the propaganda.
Okay. Did you get a lot of backlash from people when you were trying to spread that propaganda?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, things have changed a lot in more recent years, but back then, yes, absolutely. You know, it was a lot of... we'd get into physical confrontation sometimes and fights and things like that. And other times just argument, but we were so radicalized, so to speak, I was so dedicated to this movement or this group that no one could convince me that it was wrong. And, you know, I was 100% dedicated to it for a very long time.
Okay. So when I spoke to the current commander, Bert Colucci, last week, he said to me that he wouldn't walk to his car, even if it's 10 feet away, without a gun. Did you have a similar experience? Would you never go anywhere without a gun when you were in the group?
I wouldn't say that. I would say it's typically when you're involved in this stuff, you know, you're armed in some way. It may not always be a gun. It may be something else. Okay. No, I wasn't quite, I wouldn't say at all times quite that, paranoid, but, you know, right now, especially, you know, with the polarization that we're having in the country, you know, a lot of people are armed, and a lot of people, you know, I certainly was armed a lot of the time. I could say that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. He did seem quite paranoid when he said that. I actually found that quite interesting that he wouldn't walk to his car 10 feet away without a gun. Yeah. That just seems quite odd. Surely that would tell you you're doing something maybe wrong. But, yeah, that was interesting.
The thing that's interesting about that is when you're involved in this stuff and, you know, and this may come up later in your questions too, but, I mean, there's a lot of people that I know that have lost their lives, that have died, that have went to prison for years and years and years. And psychologically, when you think about these things at the time, it seems normal. Like, that's just like, oh, wow, you know, another terrible thing happened. You know, that's really unfortunate. And you don't look at it the way you should. Like, you don't look like when I'm out, I can look back and see those things and go, my God, you know, all the people that died and, you know, terrible things that happened, and you put it in a different perspective. But once you're in there, it's very cult-like. It's very much like a cult. And you just don't see those things. You just, it just, it's like you're normal. That's a, you know, for him to say that, that's his normal, you know, that's how it is.
Yeah.
When you're there, you don't really realize it.
Well, it seems like you're almost brainwashed. So like if people are dying in that, it's just like, okay, it's part of the movement. Like this is the sacrifice for the movement.
Yeah. I mean, that's how we saw it. And a lot of times, you know, I mean, the personal sacrifices, the things that different people give up, a lot of people, their entire families turn against them and they have no contact with their families and things like that. And, you know, one thing I tell the story quite often about leaving is over the years when I was dating and things like that, I would have different girls that I would bring to events, and one after the other would say, "Jeff, this is like a cult. This is like a cult." And I would get angry at the time. I was, it would make me angry. Yeah. Why does every girl I'm bringing around keep saying this? Like, what is wrong with these girls? You know? And the whole time I didn't realize it, that it was, I was thinking it was them, but really it was me. When you're involved in it and you actually take offense to that statement, you know, when someone says, "Hey, this is very cult-like," you take offense to it. And I certainly did. And I didn't really actually see it until I got out. And then once I was out and, you know, analyzing it and psychoanalyzing it and picking apart the ideology and why I did this or why I did that. I mean, it's very clear, very, very cult-like, yes.
Yeah, okay. So you were, in my research, what I read was that you were known for recruiting children between the ages of 14 to 17 for NSM's Viking Youth Corps. How do you feel about the fact that you were a part of that now that you're out of it?
Well, let me break down that statement. I mean, that's some propaganda that's coming from a group that was, you know, studying the NSM or things like that from the outside.
Yeah,
but,
interesting.
How can I say this? It's based in truth, but it's not really it wasn't the reality. Okay. So when I first joined the organization, and we're talking back in the 90s, there was something called the Viking Youth Corps. And I'm not sure exactly what year we got rid of that, but at some point we had gotten rid of that many years ago. I mean, we're talking probably 20 years ago, 15, 20, at least. Okay. Years ago, because the idea of, I mean, first of all, you know, if you have a minor coming to something, you know, you're opening yourself up to potential legal issues with that. A minor can't be crossing state lines with an adult unless it's their parent. You know, there's different laws like this. And it was like, why are we opening ourselves up to this kind of potential? And then becoming a father myself, you know, it was like, if my kids were going to something that I didn't approve of, you know, and going around with adults, you know, there might, I won't say what I would have done, but it wouldn't have been good. So I put myself in that situation too. I said, you know, we shouldn't have something like this. Basically the youth corps then at that point was taken off of the website and things of that nature, or it was just left open to like family members. For example, like if the husband and wife were involved, their child could be involved if they wanted them to be, you know, so,
okay.
But technically the division didn't exist for probably 20 years.
Okay. That does sound very cult-like.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
It kind of almost reminds me of Scientology and when they do a similar type of thing where the parents can decide to just send the children off.
Yeah. And I haven't been asked a lot about it, but there was a couple of times I remember meeting with families that were not in the movement early on, you know, back in the 90s. And basically, you know, a mother was raising a son in one case, and I don't give out names or anything. I just don't do that. But in this case, you know, I can think of two cases actually. In one, the young man was involved with gangs and drugs and things like that. And I sat down with the parents, a couple of us sat down with the parents, and I said, "Listen, if your son does drugs or anything like that, you know, it's not going to be a good thing in our group because we don't tolerate it." So the mother in this case was like, "Well, you keep them away from drugs and gangs. I don't agree with this Nazi stuff, but that sounds a whole lot better to me than gangs and drugs. So it was sometimes like, you know, like when people go to the polls and are voting for the lesser of two evils, you know, where they're, well, I don't agree with either of these candidates, but this one's not as bad as the other one. You know, I think it was a scenario like that. So sometimes that would happen too. And people find that kind of fascinating, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So straight out, I'm just going to ask, are NSM a racist hate group?
Well,
it's a very direct question, isn't it?
That's a very direct question. There's some nuance to this. I would say so now. Yes, I do believe so. When I joined and when I was a part of it, we took offense to statements like that. You know, we'd always say, "Oh, it's not about hate and things like that." And, you know, I try not to paint people with a broad brush. And when I left the organization too, you know, I did have some people that, you know, were in contact with me saying, "You didn't promote hate. That's why I joined the organization. It wasn't about hate and things like that." And towards the end of my time in there, you know, as I was going through my own de-radicalization process, I was really toning down the rhetoric, and there was no use of publicly of racial epithets or cussing or things like that. That's all out the door now. The organization's using all that kind of stuff, but I didn't feel like that was positive type of stuff. But to answer the question directly, you know, yes, I do believe it's a hateful group.
Okay. Would you say that you were a racist, or are you a racist still today?
Absolutely not a racist today, but I would say even when I joined, it wasn't for me. The racism and hate was developed in the group. It wasn't something that I grew up with. It wasn't something that I necessarily learned in the home or anything like that. My parents were never, were always against my involvement in this and tried to, many times to try to get me away from it. And, when I was younger. And, so I think, hatred and that sort of thing, racism, is developed while you're in there in the echo chamber, in the bubble. Basically that it's very cult-like and it's definitely developed there. But as far as now, absolutely not. I've completely, denounced hate and anti-Semitism and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. So did you used to get offended when people would call you a Nazi?
Not really. We didn't, when I was involved in the NSM, sometimes we would correct people if they say, "Oh, you're a Nazi." We say, "No, we don't like that. We're National Socialists," you know? So Nazi was a buzzword that the Allies had, used as it was short for National Socialist German Workers Party. They just called it Nazi. So it was a little bit of a buzzword. It wasn't nothing that we would get super offended over, but a lot of times we would try to not have people use that word.
Okay, that's interesting, because when I asked Bert Colucci if he's a Nazi, and he essentially just said yes.
Right.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, I didn't, and I think I even went, oh, I didn't expect you to just say that. I thought maybe you'd get offended by that. But he was like, nah, like if we're going to label it and say what it is, then yes.
Right. Well, and there was it may still be there now. I haven't looked at their website, but for a long time, just for branding, you know, it would say on the website, it's a National Socialist Movement, and then in quotation marks, it would say America's Nazi Party, because there was people that got social, when they heard socialist, they would get that confused, and they would think of left-wing commie socialism, you know, so sometimes, you know, we put that that branding or that messaging so people were clear about who the group was.
Yeah, okay. So looking back on it now, would you have said that you were a Nazi back then?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, okay. And so now would you say that you are a reformed Nazi?
Yeah, I don't know what the word reform, but yeah, definitely not a Nazi anymore.
Definitely not a Nazi, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. It's always interesting, like you said, when you're in it, you almost kind of got blinders on and you're blind to it. Hindsight's everything, right? You step out and then you look back and go, oh, okay.
There was a lot of that. I call it my decompression period, because I felt like when you get out, when everybody's different. Some people take years, some people it's months, you know, it really just depends. But I feel like the brain was decompressing, because once you sort of cut yourself off from that echo chamber or that bubble, and you're not surrounding yourself with it, you can kind of piece together parts of your life and things like that. And again, we're back to the cult references, but people that have left cults, they say the same thing, you know, is that basically it's the same kind of, it's a process, and you know, the brain has to, you know, you go through this time where you're beating yourself up over it and going, why did I do this so long? Why didn't I see this? Why did I think that way? You know, there's a lot of that.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. So in 2019, you left the group. And I guess I want to understand what were the reasons for you to walk away from this group that, I mean, you'd spent almost three decades in. So that's a huge chunk of your life. And then you just change. So what was it? Is there a build-up? Was there something specific that happened where you went, I can't do this anymore?
No, there was a whole bunch of reasons. And typically, you know, when someone's leaving something like this, you don't just have a, you know, one thing where you go, ah, that's it, and then you're gone. Maybe some people do, but for me it wasn't, and most of the people that we've worked with to help leave, it's not that way. For me, it was taking place over a few years, starting in about 2015, 2016.
Okay.
And I met during the course of my, actually, it was pretty interesting, because during the course of my activism with the NSM, I met a lot of different people. I was doing a lot of different things. You know, we've been in documentaries, many, 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 probably 100 different things with TV, movies, documentary films, things like that. And in 2016, I had met a man by the name of Daryl Davis. Daryl is, he was a world-renowned musician. He played with Little Richard, Chuck Berry. He sets the piano keys on fire. He's a pretty phenomenal musician. He also has I guess some people call it a hobby, where he meets with people that have been in the Klan or Nazi Party and things like that. And he starts a dialogue with them, and he's helped over 200 people walk away from the Klan and the movement. In fact, he works with my nonprofit today, Beyond Barriers. He's an incredible individual. So sitting down with him, one of the things, and this is one of the things that we use today to help other people leave, is dialogue, having empathy and compassion, and sitting down and listening. And one of the things, when I met him, he had told me a story about when he was a boy in the Cub Scouts or the Boy Scouts, and people were throwing rocks at him because he was black. I didn't cover that part earlier, but Daryl's a black man. I try not to see people by their color or race or anything anymore. So, but I leave that out sometimes. It makes it more, the story more interesting now, because you don't have too many black people that are going and meeting with Klan groups. You know, it just doesn't happen. So he's an incredible individual, but he was telling me this story. We're sitting across and we're filming for his documentary, and he's talking to me about how people were throwing rocks, adults were throwing rocks at him as a child because of the color of his skin and how it made him feel. And that's what started him on this journey to try to understand hatred and things like that. So that got to me. You know, I was doing my part for the film, and, you know, nobody knew that it bothered me. He didn't even know at the time that it bothered me, but deep down it bothered me. And that was one of the first really powerful moments that got through to me. And then about a year later, I met another filmmaker by the name of Dia Khan, and she's a Muslim woman originally from Pakistan, and her family's from Pakistan, and a similar story. And she's telling me this, and this was in the film White Right Meeting the Enemy, and you can see a little part of it. I'm not quoting it exactly, but I had filmed with Dia for weeks as part of this film, and she traveled with me across the country to an event and or to a rally and things like that, and got to know her pretty well. And again, we're, you know, filming for documentaries is no big deal. This is something I did often, but these were two individuals that really got through to me, and they remain friends to this day. So Dia's sitting across from me, and she's saying, as a child, the movement made her feel less than human, made her feel hated and ugly as a child. And I could see and feel the pain coming from her. You know, I don't know if you want to call it a vibe or whatever, yeah. But I could see it in her face. I could feel it. And it just, it's like something broke inside of me there. And the cameraman caught it because he like zooms in a little bit in the film. Really that messed with me in a good way. And she really got through to me. And I thought, wow, you know, if this ideology does this sort of thing to these wonderful, amazing people that I'd met actually through my involvement in the movement, how many other thousands upon thousands, maybe millions, I mean, countless people is it damaging?
Yeah. Yeah. That's quite powerful, isn't it?
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing.
So I guess I want to understand, how do you feel about like the Jewish, African-American, Indian-American and LGBT communities now that you're out of that?
I see people as people, you know, I judge people based on the quality of their character, not their skin color or their religion. I will say about like the Jewish people, anti-Semitism is something I struggled with even as I was first leaving the organization. Like, I feel like I was no longer a racist for a couple of years, and I stayed in the organization because it's all I knew. It's like we have a saying here that says, well, that's your bed, now you have to lie in it. You know, like this is what you've done your whole life. This is what you knew, and now you're there. So I was staying in the organization. But I still had a lot of anger and resentment towards the Jewish people. Now, that's something, that's completely gone now. And, thanks to my friends from the Simon Wiesenthal Center, they've been absolutely incredible. And, they really helped me out a lot after I left, you know, and answer my questions and getting to know Jewish people. That's something I stayed away from them for all those years completely, and getting to know some Jewish people they're just absolutely incredible. And as far as LGBTQ and the other races and things like that, I see I don't care what a person's sexuality is or what a person's race or religion is or anything like that. You know, I think there's good and bad people in all races, including white. So I just judge a people based on their character.
That must be such a huge turnaround from talking to that Bert Colucci guy. Like, he just, every community I just listed there, he just hated everything he said. It was just pure hate. And I even asked him, like, what happens if one of your children came home with an African-American or Indian-American partner, or if one of your children says, I'm gay? And his actual response was, I'd tell him to fuck off. Like, he'd just have nothing to do with them. And I was like, ooh, that's quite confronting. Did you ever have that type of a feeling about those type of groups?
Yeah, I mean, I could have told you that's what his response would have been.
Yeah.
That's actually fairly common. It doesn't always work that way in the movement. It depends on the individual, you know. So some would answer exactly like he answered, and there's others that might quietly accept it, or they wouldn't like it, but they might, you know, keep a person in their life because of their family or things like that. But like as far as myself, my family, my parents, didn't agree with what I was doing, but, you know, we just decided like, you don't talk politics. And, as far as my own children and things like that, I never really had to cross those bridges, but I mean, it was definitely not, when I was involved, my kids knew what I was doing and that sort of thing, but I wouldn't allow them to be involved. If they became, when they became adults, if they wanted to get involved, that was their choice. But it, what's interesting about it is I always, you know, there was a couple exceptions where the kids would come to something if there was a whole bunch of other kids, you know, so they could play and things like that. But for the most part, I tried to keep my kids away from the movement because some of the violence and just because it's like, this is a choice that I made and a risk that I'm taking, but it's not something that I would wish upon my kids.
That's interesting that you say that, because I would have thought that people in that cult-like environment would be so closed-minded that it's like, well, if you're my child, then you need to be in this, and would just make them be in it. But you were fine with letting them make that choice as they got older.
Well, yes. Because, well, for there's a few reasons, and different families do it different ways. You have some families that kind of, you know, push it on their kids and stuff like that, and others that just let them make their own decisions and that. But typically when you're, and I've seen it, you know, many times over the years, being involved in this, is if you push an ideal on, say you have four kids, if you push that ideal on those four kids, two of those four kids are going to rebel and go and do the complete opposite. The other two might, you know, be on board with it. So you're better off not forcing any, I don't care what it is. I don't care what political party or what you're involved in. Kids have to grow up and make decisions for themselves. And I think if you try to force your ideology down their throat, just like someone that's really hardcore into like the church, for example, if they shove that ideology down their throats, half the kids will rebel against the church. The other half will be on board with it. That's just my philosophy on it anyway.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So if one of your children came home and said, "Dad, I'm gay," how would you feel?
You talking about now?
Yeah.
That's their choice. You know,
you don't care?
Yeah.
Do you think it's a choice?
That's a good question right there. I haven't done the studies on that, there's people that say that they're people are born that way. I know an individual, and this is interesting, but I do know an individual that was part of the NSM for many, many years. And again, I'm not saying names, but it's a man that has transitioned to a woman now.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, and I accept them. That's a friend of mine. So, you know, I don't know if it, I guess I can't answer that. I don't know if people are born that way, or if they make that decision, or if it's some one way and some the other. I really don't know.
You don't know, but you don't care? Is that kind of what you're saying?
No.
You don't care either way. Yeah.
No, I don't care what. Yeah, whatever a person wants to do, as long as you're not hurting somebody else, you know, like,
yeah.
Or forcing something on somebody, you know, why not let people do what they want to do?
It just seems like such a huge turnaround in your mindset and your beliefs.
Well, it took time, you know. I mean, I was de-radicalizing while I was still in the movement, and I was trying to make changes to the movement. As you know, I thought, and it sounds ridiculous now, but I thought, you know, we'll make this into a white civil rights organization. We'll just make it a good group for white people. It won't be racist, all this kind of stuff. And it's like the saying, you know, you can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig. Yeah. You know, you know, you can't make the Nazi Party into a civil rights organization. And it sounds funny now, but at the time when I was doing it, I thought it made total sense because I was still stuck in that environment, you know. So
do you think there was a part of you that was maybe a little fearful of leaving that group because you had been there for so long?
I don't like the word fearful because I'm not really afraid of anything. You know, I consider myself an alpha male, you know, a lion, you know, in a world of lambs or things like that, you know. So it's like I don't like that word. But to be honest, like I feel like fearful is probably not the right word, but more like concerned. Because when I left, I was high profile in that organization. I was like the poster boy for Nazism in the United States, you know. So there was, there was concerns in the back of, maybe fear is the right word. I just don't like it. I don't like the word.
That's fair.
I was concerned that, you know, like society's not going to accept me back. And when I stopped talking to everybody, when I left the organization, I retired. I didn't start speaking out immediately.
Okay.
So when I retired, I already knew I was going to speak out, but I wasn't ready. I needed to go through that decompression period. And I stopped talking to people. I stopped talking to people in the group because, you know, now if you retire, you know, it's fine. But once you speak out, you're a traitor. Yeah. So at that first part, when I was just retired and trying to figure out my life and what I was, you know, when I was ready to speak out and all that kind of stuff, there was a couple of people that I was still talking to, and they would say things like, well, what are you going to do? What, you know, now that you're out, you know, like, what are you going to do? What are you going to put on your job resume? Commander of the Nazi Party for 25 years, you know, Nazi record label executive, you know, like what, you know, and those were some of the concerns in the back of my head that I was struggling with a little bit too. And that's what kept me in the organization longer than I probably should have, is because of that whole, this is your bed, now you have to lie in it. So I was trying to change the group to make it more palatable, to make it, I was trying to mainstream it is what I was trying to do. But again, lipstick on a pig, you cannot mainstream the Nazi Party. But yeah, that's what I thought I was doing at the time, until finally, after you know, a series of different things, there was killings that were going on, not from the NSM, but the ideology. You had people walking into synagogues and mosques and churches and killing people. And for me, that was some of the last straws. You know, it was like, you know, when you're in the organization, when you're in the group, we'd always say like, oh, whew, good, that wasn't one of our people. Not oh my gosh, that was horrible. Like, yeah, I mean, it was horrible, and I thought it was horrible at the time too. But the bigger concern was, okay, at least it wasn't one of our members. You know, like that's not a way to live. That's not, you shouldn't. Who can sit there and make those kind of excuses anyways? Like, those are the things that had to be, you know, analyzed when I got out. Like, how could I excuse this stuff? You know, like, how could, you know, but those were some of the final straws for me, was seeing some of that and going, why are you rationalizing this? Or why are you, okay, you know, we condemn this, but it wasn't one of our members. But this ideology in some cases is driving people to those kind of extremes is something I couldn't be on board with anymore. And I couldn't try to clean it up or whitewash it or whatever you want to call it. Yeah. I just couldn't do it anymore. As a human being, as a man, there was no, it's, I'm done, I'm out, and now on to the next chapter, you know?
It sounds like they were kind of a terrorist organization.
I don't know if I like that designation. That's a tricky thing, because
it is.
When I was in the movement, I painted people with a broad brush. You know, I said, well, all Jews are doing these terrible things. All black, you know, most blacks are doing these terrible things. So now that I'm out to, you know, I try not to use personal bias in such a way. And to classify, like with the NSM, the rules were always quite strict. Like, you don't break the law, you know, you don't, you know, hit somebody unless you're hit first at a demonstration, things like that. There was rules in place. That's not to say there wasn't people affiliated, or at one time affiliated with the group, that had went out and done some terrible things.
Okay.
But, you know, I don't know. That's kind of a tricky question. You know, if someone's openly committing terrorist acts, blowing things up and things like that, I think it's a little bit easier to make that connection. But yeah.
Well, I guess it's because the reason I kind of maybe thought of that is because you were talking about people walking into a synagogue.
Well, now those acts, yeah, those acts of people going into synagogues and mosques and churches and shooting people, those are definitely terrorist acts. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. So, but it's not like that's not something that's asked of you.
No. Okay. No, not, I mean, not in the group I was in. No, absolutely not.
Okay. That makes more sense then. Okay. I just wasn't sure if there was, I probably worded it wrong. The actual question, there would have been a better way to word it, but that's all right. We've cleared that up. Is there anything that you still believe in regards to NSM's ideology?
I don't think so. I mean, that's a good question. I don't think I've been asked that one before. So, that's an interesting question. Now, I think when people leave these organizations, and a lot of people don't understand, like a question like that, some people looking at it from the outside looking in would say, okay, well, this was just about hate and it's about race and all that. I don't have any of that racism or hate or anything like that. But now, if you want to take the political ideology and break down the talking points of the political ideology and where certain policies stand on certain things like that in the government, I mean, this could take months, you know, to pick apart. But I mean, certainly there, you know, it's like they say, there's a saying that says, you know, even a broken clock is still lands on the correct time twice a day. So there's certain things, like, for example, the NSM is against pedophiles. I'm still against pedophiles.
Yeah.
But am I aligned with the NSM? Absolutely not. But I think most people can agree, let's be against pedophiles. That doesn't make you an NSM member. So I guess that's probably the best way I can explain that.
That's true. That's fair. Like, I guess not everything they believe in is bad or considered to be hateful and...
Right.
Racist or whatever you want to call it, I guess. Right. Yeah, like that's a really good example. Yeah, you're not an NSM member if you believe that. You're just probably a decent human being.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's things like that. I mean, those are the nuances, you know. So it's kind of a question where if someone just, no, I don't agree with anything, I try to be fair, and I'm thinking of all these different nuances and like, well, I'm against pedophiles and so are they, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Are you concerned that there might be some form of retaliation against you from NSM?
Well, you know, things like that are always a possibility, you know? So when I was involved in the movement, you know, you are always, as an individual, you're always aware of your surroundings. You're always aware of the potential for any situation to go bad. I mean, I was in the movement for 27 years. I walk into a restaurant or any public place, I think about what's the worst case scenario? What could happen here? This is when I was in the movement. I would think like that. And I don't think my thinking in that sense has changed any, you know. I'm always aware of my surroundings everywhere I go. I think that's, some people, I've heard others that have left the movement, they say it's a form of like PTSD when you leave, that you still think in certain ways like that, that you're always aware of your surroundings. But I've been in a lot of violent situations and a lot of situations, and I don't panic. I handle things pretty well. So that's because I think of all the potential, what's the worst case scenario in every situation. So I wouldn't say I sit and dwell on things like that, but if somebody brings the violence, it's not going to end up well for them. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. So can I ask, do you carry a gun on you?
I'm not going to answer that.
Are you not going to answer it?
No.
Is that for safety reasons or you're just uncomfortable with that?
I'm not going to answer that. I'm not going to answer that.
That's all right. That's all right. Okay. Well, we'll move on then to something else. Like I said to you before we were recording, I want to give you a chance to clear up some of the accusations that people have made about you over the years. And I'm sure you're aware that there are people out there who believe that this is a stunt on your behalf and that it's because you were forced to step down. They're saying that it's because you signed over the control of the group to an African American man who had conned you into thinking he was going to help the group out financially, but really he was trying to infiltrate the group in order to bring it down. What do you say to people who believe that this is a stunt?
Well, I'm happy to answer that question. As far as it being a stunt, being involved in something for 27 years, there is no stunt as far as getting out. Once you, like I said earlier, if I would have just retired and walked away or something like that, the movement doesn't look down upon that. People retire, people walk away all the time. But when someone starts speaking out against it, you know, then they're viewed in a different manner. And that puts you in a pretty volatile situation. You know, like I said, I don't really have any fear of anything, but it's, you set yourself up in a sense for those people that I was with, that I worked with and all that for years and years and years in many cases. Now they view me as a traitor. So, I mean, a person's mind can go where it wants with that. But there's no going back, you know, like I've heard that too. Like, well, maybe he's just saying that now and he's going to go back. There is no going back. If you retire, of course you could go back. If you just walk away quietly, you can go back. But once you've denounced and you speak out against it, there's no going back. There, the movement, I certainly, when I was involved, whenever we saw somebody speaking out, it was like, well, that person's done. There is no going back. Even if they change their mind or whatever, there is no going back. Once you speak out against it, there's no going back. So the people that are saying, oh, he's still a Nazi or this is some kind of stunt, they don't really have any understanding of this world. You know, when I said this world, I mean the world of white nationalist extremism. They don't understand it. It works much, in many ways, probably like some might view the mafia or a gang or things like that. It's just, there's no going back. So it would be for it to be a stunt, it doesn't even make sense. It's not really I find it frustrating sometimes, like when people would say that or ask those questions, because it's like, man, how could they possibly think that, you know, especially yeah. when you've changed your whole life around. But I do get it. You know, I look at it from the outside looking in from others' perspectives, and they don't really understand how the movement works, and they don't understand how that lifestyle or that environment is. So a lot of times I try not to get frustrated or bothered by it, because they just don't understand that world. You know, it's like, I might not understand the world of scuba diving because I've never scuba dived, you know? So I don't pretend like I'm an expert on it because I've never done it. So, I think that's where the line is drawn, I think, is they just don't really truly understand how it works. And, you know, I've heard other people say, well, maybe he's doing this because, for whatever reasons, people have different accusations, and you don't just change your entire life after 27 years for nothing. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, talking about some of those accusations that people are making, some people believe that it's, you know, well, they're suggesting that it's because you're facing legal ramifications for your role in the violence that broke out in the Charlottesville rallies in 2017. Now, I'm not going to ask you about that because that's a legal matter, but could you understand why maybe some people would be skeptical?
Well, I've heard that, and let me clarify that. And, you know, I can't talk too much about it because that's an ongoing issue. But what I can say is that that's a civil matter. It's not a criminal matter. So now a criminal matter means you can, you know, go to jail or things like that. This is a civil matter. I'm being sued by this group of people because I was there. I was at that event and I was there. So I was a leader of not of the event, because I wasn't even speaking there, but I was the leader of the NSM at the time. The NSM was there. So I'm being sued for being there. It's a civil matter. Now, I've heard people make that accusation where, well, he's being sued, so that's why he would do this. You know, he would, you know, leave the movement. First of all, I was sued several years ago. This lawsuit's been going on 3 years now, but I was sued about 5-6 years ago. Maybe it was longer than that. I was sued once before and I won that lawsuit. And I'm not saying, you know, this one's still ongoing, but you don't change your whole entire life because someone's suing you. And I can say, you know, I was running the NSM 88 records before. I had income. I had job security, all that. I gave up everything to walk away from the movement. I gave up everything I knew my entire life and walked away. Now, you don't walk away from your entire life because you're being sued by somebody. I mean, that to me, that's one of the more ridiculous accusations right there, because first of all, I don't have a whole lot they could take anyways. I'm not a wealthy person or anything like that. And what I did have is gone because I'm no longer involved.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Were you paid a wage to be the leader of that group?
Not for NSM. I made my my income primarily from the record label.
Okay, I see. I guess another accusation that has been made is that you were in it for your own financial gain, which seems interesting since you weren't paid for that actual role. How do you feel when you hear people coming out and saying these accusations? Because I have read, and I don't know if you will want to talk about this, but I have read that your ex-wife also made a statement similar to that as well, that you were in it to boost your ego, get a Jim Jones type of following and to make money. I mean, is that fair? Is that a fair representation of your time in that group?
No, absolutely not. And see, those accusations were made about me when I was in before too. Anyone that's successful at what they're doing in the movement, anyone that has any sort of following, anyone that has any sort of business is constantly accused of these type of things in that. Maybe it's not just in the movement, but it's in life in general when someone sees someone else where they feel is doing well. You know, they say things like that or think things like that. But to be completely honest, I mean, there was not a lot of money involved in there is people in white nationalism that seem to have done pretty well, but financially, but I certainly didn't. It just was not.
It's not a get rich type of scheme.
No. And there's a whole lot more things I could have done to make a lot better money than that probably for many years. It was not the motivating factor was never money. In fact, for years and years, initially when I was involved, before I had the record label, when I was getting into the music end of it and doing that for a living, I hesitated to even do that because I thought, wow, like, I don't know if I want to make money off of this. You know, I don't know if it's, you know, because you had this, there was this thought by a lot of the, you know, blue collar and working class people that everything that one makes is put back into the struggle. You know, that's, and you made a reference to Scientology, and I've heard that about Scientologists where they're having, in some cases, giving up homes and everything for the struggle. And that is very much like how the movement was. You sacrificed everything, and some of the guys sacrificed their lives.
Yeah. Do you think that's a control thing to sacrifice these things?
Well, I mean, for me, it was a choice. You know, like I chose to do that. I chose this path. Nobody's making anybody join these things. You know, they're doing it of their own free will. So, I mean, that's an interesting question. I don't think, I feel like it was a decision, you know, like this was a choice. And obviously it was a bad decision. It was a wrong decision. But when you're part of it, it's pretty much depending on the level, a person's level of involvement. But for me and for a lot of people, it was all encompassing. Like it was your whole world, you know.
Again, I'm not sure if you're going to want to answer this question because it does relate to your ex-wife. I understand that she had a daughter from a past relationship and that daughter was part African-American, and that the accusation is that you hid that information from the group because it goes against everything that they believe in. Is there any truth to that?
I don't want to talk about her at all, okay. You know, as far as going forward. I mean, her whole thing was to get attention and try to damage my reputation at the time because, you know, when you go through a divorce and things like that, some people handle it well, other people handle it very bitterly, and I'd prefer not to discuss her.
That's okay. Yeah, that's fine. I just thought I'd ask the question, and like I said before, it's totally up to you what you want to answer, so that's fine. Okay, so I did read an article about you recently that said you can be quite defensive about the extent of your wrongdoing. Do you think there's any truth to that? Are you in any sort of denial, maybe about the pain that you've caused to other communities by being a part of this group?
I don't think I deny that. In fact, when I've spoken California, I was at it was called the State of Hate, and it was a assembly. Oh my gosh, I should know what it's called. But there were senators there, Congress people, you know, policymakers there, and you know, I went to give my speech, and this was last fall. And last year, about almost a year ago now, and I didn't think about it until I got there, and I heard someone discussing about how the NSM damaged people in that local community, the organization was very prominent and active in that area, and I didn't even think about it until literally I was there at this event, and this is one of my earlier on speaking engagements, and I heard somebody talking about how afraid they were from the group being there, and I apologized. Nobody asked me to apologize since I've been out. No one said, you need to do this, you have to do that. No one's done that, you know, but when I realized and put two and two together that, wow, this was an area that was affected by the group I was a part of. And you know, I apologized to the local community there on my own accord, because I think that's, I mean, part of the, a lot of the work I do now is my way of giving back and making amends, trying to make things right. And, you know, giving something back to the community for the hate and intolerance that I spewed for so long. So I don't think I'm particularly defensive or anything like that. Maybe if you have an exact example or something, I'd be happy to answer it. But I think I'm pretty open and transparent about what I've done.
Yeah. No, I would agree. It was just something that there was no example in the article. It was just something that was kind of, it was almost like a throwaway line. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because it literally all it said is that you can be very defensive about the extent of your wrongdoing. And I thought, well, where's the example?
Right.
But there was no example. So I thought, okay, well, I'll ask you and give you a chance to pick that up. But like, I feel like you're not being defensive at all. I feel like you're being very open. Yes, it is interesting, I guess, how people take things differently. And again, they might be people that maybe are just still a bit skeptical.
I think that's part of it. There is people that they just don't understand how everything works. And there's people that have said, you know, like I've had this from the far left, and you know, the far left, extreme far left, like the extremists, they hated me before when I was in the movement. They still hate me now because they feel like when I left the organization that I should have destroyed it, that I should have doxed all the members of the group or things like that. What they don't understand is that there's corporate responsibility. There's a matter of honor and things like that. I don't sit and drop names now to this day. And I had a corporate responsibility when I was part of the organization. We signed in the group, all the leaders of the organization signed non-disclosure agreements, which are legally binding documents that you don't, if you leave the group, you don't drop information on the group when you leave, because you've signed non-disclosure agreements and you have corporate responsibilities and things like that. So again, it goes back to people not really understanding how these things work, because the organization that I was part of was not organized like a street gang in that way. It was organized in some manners, a little bit of both, a little bit street gang, a little bit corporation.
Yeah. Okay. The last accusation I want to ask you about, and then we can move off this topic, is that you have a whole bunch of Nazi merchandise and that you're not willing to throw it away because it would be like throwing money away. Is that true? Are you willing to answer that?
Of course, there's certain things that I'm keeping from my, you know, time involved in the group and things like that. But as far as like sitting on a whole bunch of stuff, you know, that's just not something that I think a lot of people don't really understand this, you know, again, they don't understand this sort of thing. So,
yeah. I'm just trying to figure it out, because I guess I'm trying to understand if people think that, maybe that's why people don't think you're being genuine, but you're saying that that's not true. You don't have like a whole entire like chest full of all this Nazi stuff.
Can we pause this recording? Can you pause this so I can explain this?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, we'll move on. Where do we go now? Again, I don't know if you'll answer this though, but are you working with law enforcement to fight against this organization, or is that something you can't discuss?
That's, again, like, I don't drop names. I don't drop names on anything. In fact, I'm working on a book, and even in that, names and everything's being changed. So I don't, to do the kind of work that I'm doing now with in de-radicalizing others, all credibility and things like that are thrown out the door if you're, this is a tough question to answer, because like, if law enforcement asks me like, well, how do extremists think? How does the psychology of it work? I'm happy to discuss those things. As far as, am I dropping names on people or anything like that? Yeah. Absolutely not. I don't do that.
Yeah. So let's talk about what your end goal is now that you are out.
As far as what I do now, I run a company. I'm the CEO for a company called Beyond Barriers. Beyond Barriers is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. We have a group of people. A lot of them are formers, and I mentioned Daryl Davis a little bit earlier. He's with us as well, and a number of other people that we do outreach, we peace building, public speaking. Now with COVID, you know, that kind of put a damper on all that. But, you know, our goal is to help people walk away from whatever form of extremism they're in, whether it's far right, far left, a gang, a cult, a religious extremism. You know, our approach to that is a little bit different than a lot of the, there's other groups out there that do this kind of work as well. But our approach is not to be politically oriented. We're nonpartisan. Of course, some of the different individuals have different political leanings on their own. But as an organization, we don't get behind anything like that as far as any specific political ideologies. And sitting down with people and helping them walk away from their previous life.
And how's that going? Are you finding it to be successful? And
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I actually wasn't going to start Beyond Barriers for another year. And, you know, I wanted to put some more time between myself and the work. But we ended up forming it up this year because it needed to be done. There was a lot of people. I had my personal website, jeffscoop.com. So many people were reaching out that it was like, well, why are we waiting? You know, we shouldn't wait any longer if there's this much of a demand. And one of the biggest draws, not just because a lot of the people knew who I was from my time in the movement. So, I mean, that's a draw right there. And some of the other individuals as well is because they were known individuals. But I think the biggest draw to Beyond Barriers is the fact that we're not aligned with the far left. And that doesn't mean we're right leaning either. Yeah. But one of the things that a lot of people had said to me when I first left, I mean, literally one after the other, was when they leave the movement, do they have to become Antifa? Do they have to become a communist? Do they have to be an anarchist? You know, and it sounds kind of funny from the outside looking in that they would ask that. And they were asking me that, like, hey, are you a communist now? Are you Antifa now? And at first it was getting me angry. You know, I was like, man, why do they keep asking this? You know, like, I'm not affiliated with that stuff. And, you know, but I take myself back into their shoes. I was the same way, you know, at that time, you know, like I felt like everybody that left was affiliated with that. And some of the former extremists are affiliated with that. Yeah. And some of the other groups are affiliated with that. So specifically, I see some of that extreme far left stuff as extremism. I see the parallels to the movement in some of the most extreme corners of the far left that are exactly the same. The ideology is different. It's completely different. But the parallels to the individuals, to the cult-like mentality, and I've seen it in jihadism and religious extremism too, which surprised me a little bit. But after leaving, the parallels between all these different groups in that way, as far as extremism, are almost identical. So our approach to de-radicalization is completely different than most of the other groups that are out there that are asking people to lean, you know, a certain way to come away from this. And that's not, it's not a natural progression in the first place. If someone flips from the far right to the far left, I see it as jumping from one form of extremism to another. We want people to, you know, find a somewhere in the middle. You can be left-leaning, you can be right-leaning, but don't fall into that extremist trap and go from one extreme to another, because you certainly haven't de-radicalized. You've just switched your extremism from one to another.
Do you think that's part of the problem when people come out of these cults, because they've been in that type of environment where it's extremism, that they think that now they have to go that extreme the other way?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's a big problem, and I've seen it. We monitor. One of the things we do is we monitor the far right, the far left, and other forms of extremism, and we see that, and we'll just use it. I don't want to keep painting the far left in a bad light, but there is people on the far left that'll say, and the reason they don't like me now is because I say these things, because I say, no, someone that leaves the far right should not go to the extreme versions of the far left, you know, and I'm against doxing and all these other things, because I see the harm. There's people that have killed themselves, committed suicide over being doxed, and it opens you up to other problems too, where people, you know, a crazy person or an angry person could come and take violence out on whoever is doing it. And the far right and the far left both do it, the doxing, and it's not healthy. It's not good. And there is that stigma where why each and every person that was contacting me was asking that question is because there are formers and there are other groups out there that will encourage people to go from the far right to Antifa, and it's not healthy. It doesn't work most of the time. In fact, it's they're not de-radicalizing that individual at all. They're just changing their they're going from one cult to another almost.
Yeah. Okay. Are you a believer that everything happens for a reason, and that maybe you had to go through almost 3 decades in that group to now come out to be doing this work?
That's a good question. I would sure rather wish I didn't.
I'm sure. Yeah.
But, because of that experience, I have a lot of knowledge of an understanding of the psychology of it, of what it takes to help people leave and what gets people there, and kind of how to unwork some of those things. So in a way, you know, yeah, maybe things do happen for a reason. I'm not one to question destiny or fate or things like that. I mean, I think, you're probably right there. I think things probably do happen for a reason. And, I wish I would have figured all this stuff out a long time ago and left many years ago. But, I think a lot about, especially during that decompression period, about some of the people that had died, you know, and some of the people that went to prison for 40 years and things like that. Maybe if they had done something different, that wouldn't have happened. Or maybe if they hadn't been involved, probably if they hadn't been involved, you know, a friend of mine that's out, he posed this question to me, and it was deep, you know, and he said, I think about the church down the street from me. And he goes, and I wondered to myself, he goes, how many people in that church do you think know somebody or met somebody that murdered somebody? He asked me, and I said, I don't know. I said, probably nobody, maybe nobody, maybe one person, maybe nobody. He goes, how many people do we know from our past that have done things, bad things like that? I was like, whoa, wow.
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah. And yeah. it's things like that that make you go, you know, reevaluate things and stuff like that. So, I mean, I definitely don't regret the path I'm on now, and I'm helping people and things like that, which is important, but it was definitely the wrong path to be on for a very long time.
Yeah. But like you said, I mean, you being in that, it does give you that knowledge that us on the outside don't have about the workings of the organization. So it is so powerful.
Doing my best.
Doing your best. Yeah, you're trying. I just got one more question for you and then I'll let you go. If you were to reflect on your time at the National Socialist Movement, how do you feel?
Wow.
Big question.
That's a good question. one thing that I've done since I've been out, and I didn't even really think of these things. These were things that other people had suggested for me, you know, like when I was, some of the speaking engagements I've had and some of the things that I've done, like, I spoke on leadership, to a state group of business people and influencers and things like that about leadership. And I spoke with another group about branding and, you know, how to, you know, like build a successful corporation and things like that. I wouldn't even have thought of this stuff, but when it was brought up to me by people that I know that had suggested these things, they said, you built an organization when you joined the NSM, it was a small group. You built it into the largest group of its kind in America. And you also took a business, and I also rebranded the organization in 2016, and you ran a record label and built it up to the largest of its kind in the country, the white nationalist music, you know. So I didn't really think about that, but those are skills that I have. So basically, I'm taking the skills that I, you know, like the saying, when life hands you lemons, you make lemonade. I'm taking the skill set that I have and I'm doing good things with it now, you know, and I'm trying to help others and use the skill set I have to be of benefit to society instead of being the bad guy or someone promoting things that cause division and divisiveness. I'm using it for peace building and to help change lives. So I guess that kind of sums it up as far as I can spend all day long beating myself up over my past. And believe me, I do enough of that. But trying to stay positive and then look at that skill set and do something useful with it. That's the best thing I think we can do as human beings and try to move forward with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'd like to kind of go on the record when I put this out there, and I'll leave this in, that I absolutely believe that you are being genuine. And I think it's great. And I think the work you're doing is really, really great and positive. And it's so powerful what you have, your knowledge and that. And, like, you know, we can sit here and I can sit here and ask you all these questions and beat you up about your past, but you've come out of that. And I think it's so powerful what you're doing now. So I think it's really great.
Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, I'll leave the last word to you. If there's anything else that you want to say and put out there, go for it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the program. It's really a great honor and I appreciate it. And hopefully maybe there's some people out there that are listening that need help walking away from whatever form of extremism you're involved in, whether it's a gang, whether it's right-wing, left-wing, religious extremism, occult, anything like that, feel free to reach out to us. We have an experienced staff. We've got people that have done prison time that you know, can help with programs and things like that from, you know, guys or ladies that are just getting out of the system there. We've got a great staff, so reach out to us. And again, thanks for having me on the program, Chantel.
Thank you so much for being so honest and real and giving me your time. And yeah, I really appreciate it. And the work you're doing is great.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. So until next time, be the change the world needs. But for now, school's out, class dismissed.